Welcome, 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 everybody. Welcome. It's that time again. It's that time. It is a Wednesday. It is 8 o'clock or thereabouts on a Wednesday, and it is February the 17th. I am the son, also known as Eric Payne, and you are the...
I am the mother of my son, Eric Payne. And
your name is...
K-Thompson
Live, everybody. Go ahead.
And it is cold outside. Boy, I'm telling you.
As cold as it was.
We have friends of mine are in the islands, and they're saying they're living well there, and they're warm, and Gene is warm. And
say hello to our co-host, Mr. Wayne
Gilman. Wayne, how are you doing?
Hi. Good evening. How's everyone?
I'm fine. How are you?
It seems like every time I call now, I'm getting this message saying that there are no programs for the next 24 hours, and then I got to dial back again. I guess
yeah,
there must be a glitch in the system.
You were a little late in dialing in, Wayne, that's why.
Oh, that's why that happens.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay, not a problem, but I'm glad that we're all together, and... this has been some week, weather-wise, tell you that much. You know, I've had floods like I've never seen before, you know?
Yeah.
No one could say there's no global warming out there. I saw so much rain yesterday, I probably could have washed my underwear in it while trying to get the water out of my home, you know. It was just one of those things, but it's just crazy weather, but good to be here, and I gather everyone is all excited about the elections that are, or the caucuses, I should say, that are taking place.
Yeah, but
know.
Listen, we're going to be talking about it probably later on in the program, you know, we're going to get to the whole political thing. So, but anyway,
okay.
You know, we have been waiting on the air. You remember Glenda Taylor, don't you?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
I think she's on the air right now. Glenda, are you there?
Oh, very good.
Yes, hi, Wayne Gilman, Eric Payne, and Kate.
Hi,
Allen.
How are you?
Okay.
Hello, Glenda.
I'm here, yes.
How's the weather up there in New York State?
Well, it's fine. I'm not complaining. It's really only the last two weeks that the weather has gotten extremely cold and... unpredictable.
I didn't say New York State. I said New York State, but I didn't mean it. I mean there. I just don't want to give the town of where you're calling from, but it's far away from us here.
I'm in Suffolk County.
You're in Suffolk County since you already let the cat out the bag, Glenda.
Yeah, I might as well say I'm in Suffolk County. It's cold, and it's about 10 degrees less in the city. But like I said, I'm not complaining. It's pretty, you know.
You think about it,
this is February. We only have maybe like a month and a half more of this type of weather, if that much. And
uh-huh.
we really had a great October, November, and most of December.
Uh-huh.
Well, I tell you, Glenda's not a landlord, so I guess she doesn't know the problems that people go through. I can only speak for myself in Westchester County. And, you know, it has been a mild winter, and I think we have 33 days left, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it seems like the snow was worse than what it was a year ago, and that cold snap,
Boring.
I never want to relive
Boring.
That again.
Boring. We're talking about the snow. We have other, you know, hot ash issues to talk about, and because it's probably going to be snowing again now, Wayne, that you mentioned it. You're going to be the cause of it.
Okay.
Anyway, you know Glenda again. Glenda is an author and a writer. I know an author and a writer. She's written some heck of a good books, and a lot of good books, and I've talked about them over the years. And, you know, we talked about Jalamuso's drum, and I called her because of the fact that I wanted her to explain what a Jalamuso is, and, you know, she's only going to be on for a short period of time. She has consented to this. And then right after that, we're going to be talking to Richard Leslie, which is, I think many people might remember him, the writer and producer. And he wrote Uptown Saturday Night, right? Right there? Okay. All right, so Glenda, Jalamuso's drum. How did you come up with the title Jalabuso? What is
That's just another word for griot. And it's a female griot. And it's used in, you know, different parts of West Africa. That's not the only, and that's that. What is there primarily? The word means cultural historian, storyteller, someone who, you know, tells the history.
Someone who what?
Records the history, records and passes it down, oral history, the history of a people, the culture of people.
Out of all the people that you talked about, and you talked about Aretha Franklin, Diana Ross, Diane Carroll, Chrissy Houston, Etta James, Ruth Brown, Whoopi Goldberg, so many others, Lena Horne, rather, Marian Anderson, Nina Simone, Mississippi, goddamn, Eartha Kitt, Josephine Baker, and so many others. So how did you get about choosing these women to talk about? Their lives absolutely fascinating.
Well, what I was saying was that a West African or an African griot is different from an African-American griot. I explained it in detail, you know, in the beginning of the book. And I'm really saying that the African-American female artists who were born before 1955, and I'm sure, you know, it's still occurring, have used their autobiographies to tell the history of African-American people and our story in ways that traditional historians did not. And there's a lot of information in their autobiographies which enlighten us as far as what was going on during the period and different terms, different occurrences that were happening. And those specific women, their books have a lot of stories.
Yeah.
Very interesting stories.
And, you know, you also mentioned Eartha Kitt, who I didn't mention last week, you know, because you have so many people in here. What about Eartha Kitt? Why did you find her so fascinating?
Well, Eartha Kitt was a part of the Civil Rights Movement. I don't think that's most of, you know, our image, but she was very open in her autobiography. She was blacklisted by President Lyndon Johnson. She tells why, and she goes into stories, and of course she traveled internationally, telling you her experience in different countries and what it was like to be an African-American female in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. So it's very interesting. The same thing with Nina Simone. She tells her story because she was a young 4-year-old child prodigy, and she tells her story because she did not want to be categorized, and she really wanted to be a classical pianist. And she was a classical pianist, but that was not acceptable for her as a female African-American in her period. So she ended up having the talent, using the skill, and integrating that with blues, jazz, folk, and the other areas which she was permitted in ways, you know, different to perform.
You know, you also, you know, I forgot to mention last week and, you know, a few weeks ago when I was talking about your book, you also mentioned, you know, great men like Lester Young, you know, Count Basie, Charlie Parker, you know, Jackie Wilson, Little Richard. So what about them? Sam Cooke, you know?
Well, I didn't analyze their autobiographies, but they're all fascinating. They all have great stories. I guess part two would be, you know, analyzing the autobiographies of the men. For example, I just finished reading Harry Belafonte's autobiography, which was put out, I think it was 2002, and it's really very fascinating. I knew he was a civil rights activist. I never knew that he was as close as he was to Dr. King and his family. And, you know, he spent a lot of money, and he did a lot. And basically Martin Luther King, according to his autobiography, was where, when he came to New York, that's where he went, and that's where he stayed, and that's who he socialized with and, you know, kind of hung out, and they had a lot of conversations. And his autobiography is very fascinating because, you know, he goes to the 30s and the 40s and McCarthyism and communism. He had an excellent relationship. And as a matter of fact, his role model was Paul Robinson. He was close to John Killens. He had a good relationship with Bobby Kennedy. And he tells all those stories. And his autobiography would definitely be on the top of the list as one, which is telling. And he tells it from a perspective. Also, he integrates the experience as his family was from Jamaica, and he tells that, and he talks about life and the West Indian culture in Harlem and in America, and specifically New York, you know, during a period of the 40s and the 50s.
Uh-huh. What about, now I want to ask you maybe back two more questions. I want to ask you first about Josephine Baker. You know, a lot of people don't know who she was, but she was famous. She was famous here and abroad, and, you know, and she played quite a role in, I guess, the early, what, 30s?
World War II. She was very much a part of World War II, and she was working for the Allies. She did a lot of undercover work. She put her life in danger, and she was honored by the French government at her death. You know, she had like a military-type funeral, and thousands of people came out in the street in France to,
wow, really?
You know, mourn her death. And uh-huh. In some way, she's probably, you know, more remembered at this point in France than she is, you know, in America.
Yeah,
'cause I never knew who she was until the 70s, the 1970s. I saw her one time, and she was being interviewed on the Johnny Carson show. And that was but I didn't know her history. I knew he respected her, but I didn't know her history until, you know, much later.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, fascinating history. I read about her in a book that I have here. I think it's called The Black Book. And there's so much information about people, you know, of long ago. And there was one other person I was going to ask you about, but I can't think of that name right now. I'll think about it in a minute. But anyway, which of these women? Oh, Whoopi Goldberg. Now, why was Whoopi so fascinating? You know, watching her on The View, she is really fast, quick, and she doesn't let anybody get away with anything, you know, knocking her race or knocking women or, you know, having these women be very silly. So, you know, she's really a fascinating person. Very powerful also, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, she's very, very interesting because she was born in March, I think it is, of 1955. So her perspective is very different from, say, someone like Josephine Baker or Eartha Kitt, because she's much younger than they are. But at the same time, she, you know, she was a part of a period in which she was a part of opening doors and being the first. And she used her comedy. She used her comedy, her you know, stage shows, her Broadway shows, and her voice to make a difference.
Wow.
Even until today, it's not about The View, but even until today, she's very outspoken. She, you know, she tells you what she says what she has to say. And politically, like they were talking about Justice Scalia, and she was saying, you know what, I think we need to talk about this. Give ourselves a couple of weeks before we get into the detail and respect, you know, the mourning, you know, his family's ability to mourn.
Yeah. You know, there's another question I want to ask you. Why were you so drawn to write about these women? They're fascinating, no doubt. Nina Simone, her history is fascinating. Every single one of them. Eartha Kitt.
Well, the reason why is because, one, they were in a period, and even in a period where women, you know, were expected to take the back seat. And basically, when you think about the civil rights movement, with the exception of Coretta Scott King and Rosa Parks, and this is Black History Month, by the way, you really don't think of those women. And I was very surprised to realize, you know, they were, even Lena Horne, they were very involved. They were doing things. They were blacklisted. They were active participants in this movement, and specifically artists. And we don't see artists the way so many of them are. I mean, we think about, you know, like Anika Giovanni, the Last Poets, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, but much further back, these artists were doing things to move and to break down, you know, move our culture forward, to break down barriers. Like Lena Horne refused when she realized that the black soldiers in World War II were really being treated poorly, and they were treating the German prisoners of war basically better. They had better seating, they had better whatever, and they expected the black men to stand in the back of the room, and she had to stand up there and perform. And she refused. She rejected it. She started. She got very upset. She walked to the back, performed for the black soldiers, and told them she wasn't doing it anymore. And she protested. You know, she had to take her bruises because she did that. But she said she wasn't going to respect the German soldiers who we were allegedly fighting because, wow, you know, of the color of their skin, and disrespect the black men, which, you know, Spike Lee showed that in the film Miracle at St. Anne's, how, you know, what the black soldiers had to go through. So the artists, to answer your original question, specifically the females, their role has really not been shown. You know, the traditional history books, you know, they're basically not there and invisible. And then when you hear about the movement, you don't really hear about how involved they were and what they did in their role. So I thought it needed to be done.
And I'm looking at the name Catherine Dunham, also a dancer, you know, and then let's see. Yeah, Catherine Dunham and Carmen de Lavalot, you know, different dancers that, you know, I had some that I had studied under. So they had wonderful histories. I can think of one, I can see her face, but I can't think of her name right now. But these women that you wrote about, Billie Holiday, Tina Turner. You know, Tina Turner is still around, right?
Yes, Tina Turner is still around. I didn't analyze her autobiography, but I read it. It's called I, Tina. It's very good. Billie Holiday, of course, she did Strange Fruit. And, you know, we know what that was about. Catherine Dunham was a fighter until she died. I think she was in the 80s when she was fasting about how the Haitians were treated. Remember when the Haitians were not allowed into the country? And she was fasting. It wasn't until, I think it was Dick Gregory and Farrakhan begged her to stop fasting because she was a very long fast. She stopped, but she was protesting. You know, how to hate, because she loved Haiti. She traveled internationally. She spent a great deal of time in Haiti, and she studied the Haitians, the Trinidadians, the Jamaicans, different aspects of the African diaspora, and she put that in her dance and her music. And she too, she did many things. Because she was, you know, like when she would go out, they didn't want dark-skinned dancers, and they didn't want them to be a part of it. And she refused to accept that. And she refused to accept audiences that, you know, would not allow black people there, or the black people had to, you know, sit somewhere in the back. She said, she did performances in which she showed, you know, people, you know, the lynching, and dealt with very controversial subjects to the point that the State Department did not want to fund her, even though her company was very popular, more popular than a lot of other companies that were receiving money from the State Department when they went out internationally.
Yeah. Years ago, I took a class under her when she had come to New York. I forget exactly where the studio was, but it was someplace in New York City in the Village. And I was absolutely thrilled to be sitting there even looking at her. Also, another person, you know, we don't hear a lot about, but Pearl Primus. Remember that her name? She studied in Africa. She was a scholar, and she was married to, I forget his name now, a tall man who had studied the Washoe dancing. And he brought this Watusi dancing, to the United States. And I remember seeing him perform in the Village. You know, he was doing master classes at the time. Want to comment on Catherine Dunham?
Catherine Dunham?
Yeah, Catherine Dunham. You just finished talking about it. I was just saying, what about Pearl Primus? Do you remember her?
No, I'm not as familiar with her as I am with Catherine Dunham.
I think you were referring to Jeffrey Holder, the late Jeffrey Holder.
Oh, yeah, that's the wife, the husband of Carmen DeLavalade, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he was. Right. He's really good. And Carmen DeLavalade, I saw her about 4 years ago, and she was still performing, and she was really absolutely wonderful. It was a cast of older, it was right near NYU, it was a cast of older female dancers. It was really beautiful, and she is so beautiful. And as a matter of fact, Jeffrey Holder, I didn't know, you know, their history. I didn't know he was married, but as soon as he sat down next to me, because before we went into the performance, and all of a sudden, you know, you hear this voice. And it's, you know, it's like there's some people like a Barry White, you know, there's some voices. When you hear this voice, all of a sudden, you know, you're listening to. And he was there, and of course, he was there because his wife was performing.
Yeah, Carmen.
And I think this is a history that our young people need to read and need to know, because I think it would help Black artists and support them and how they could better use their art, because they have much more freedom, much more access, much more technology to be able to do, you know, their performances and enrich their art.
We've talked about this before, but the things that they had to go through, you know, in order to be recognized, you know, as excellent performers, you know. I'm also thinking about, of old people, Marian Anderson. You know, I forgot to mention that, but you have so many other people in your book that I'm not mentioning right now, but I'm just looking at a few of them. But Marian Anderson. You know, and where did she sing? Where did she sing that she wasn't allowed to sing, and finally got the
Constitutional Hall. She was going to say at Constitutional Hall, and the Daughters of the American Revolution didn't want her to sing there. And Eleanor Roosevelt was appalled because she was an internationally huge megastar. And she said, no, we're not going to do this. And not long after the Lincoln Memorial was completed, Eleanor Roosevelt made arrangements for her to sing in front of Lincoln Memorial. And that was considered the first, quote-unquote, march on Washington.
Right.
And I think it was 1939. I think that was the year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the year. But I'm just saying, we have a rich history, and if we study this history, if we learn this history, artists today will, you know, think more and be more conscious of their art, and they will realize how much power they really have. Because I understand there was a controversy about Beyonce's performance at the Super Bowl. Because, you know, and I was saying, wow, Beyonce did that. I was proud of her. Because I'm not listening to her. I don't really listen to her music or know her music. And I like music that shows consciousness. And that's the first time that I have known her to do that type of performance where, you know, she was getting so much criticism. And then she just basically said, please don't kill us. And it sounded very much like what Janet Jackson did back in the day, you know, kind of like a Rhythm Nation type performance.
Uh-huh.
And I think the artists need to do that. I remember Jamie Foxx, after he spoke to Harry Belafonte, he realized that he needed to do more, you know, and he didn't even make comments about that. Because, you know, those people went through a lot. They took the blows that I know I didn't take, and I was able to go through doors because of them. And the younger people who, you know, like in the Beyonce age group, they have opportunities which they need to take advantage of.
Yeah, and they can. That John LaMusa's drummer is a great book. People can get it. How can people get it, Glenda?
They can go just on the internet, Amazon.com, and other books. Just type it in JALIMUS drum, John LaMusa's drum, Glenda R. Taylor. Just stick my little name in there, and you'll find it.
Okay, and we will certainly want everybody to go and check that book out. You know, you mentioned Harry Belafonte, and just he made a little news.
Oh, his book is called My Song.
Well, I'm just talking about the news that he made this week about when he came out in support of Bernie Sanders. You know, as you were talking earlier, and Harry has always been very active politically and socially.
from his days of working with Dr. King.
Yeah.
And so he's made the move to Bernie. And I'm just wondering, you know, is that a signal? Would you also think, Wayne, about how much influence someone like Harry Belafonte, because he's kind of an old school, the old school guard of the civil rights movement, as is why am I forgetting his name momentarily? Wow.
John Lewis?
What did you say, Glenda?
John Lewis?
John Lewis, yes. Because
yeah.
John Lewis, as you know, is for Hillary, and he's out of the civil rights movement of that era, of course, and Harry Belafonte is for Bernie. So pretty interesting how some of the, even the old guard is falling on opposite sides, at least in the Democratic party or race. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, well, I think certainly it's a very important point.
I respect Harry Belafonte. I respect him. I thought his book was great and wonderful, and I respect our ability to, you know, choose the person that we would like to support. But I'm 100% supportive of Hillary Clinton. I think that if she were a man, especially white male, that there would be no question whether you're a Democrat or Republican, she would have 100% reported. She would definitely support. She would definitely be the next president of the United States without question.
If she was a white male,
when you listen to her speak,
if she was a white male, there would be no Barack Obama. Hillary was a white male. Barack Obama wouldn't have got elected president.
Did you hear that, Glenda?
That's, well, you know what? I have to be honest. I was 100%, you know, President Obama supported me. I mean, I supported him, but I was, because Hillary is from New York. Well, she was a senator from New York. I loved her. I respect her. I want her to win. And, of course, you know, between Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, I, you know, became, you know, a fan. But like you said, if she were a male, she probably, yeah, you're probably right. But at this point, when you listen to her speak specifically about foreign policy and other issues, she's so articulate, she's so sharp. There's not one of those guys in the Republican or Bernie Sanders that really compete with her. And they're only basing it on the fact that she's, you know. Exactly,
right.
Bill Clinton.
Right. Well,
you
now
know,
the battle.
She's so smart. It's just like Al Sharpton.
The battle now seems to be that she's battling it out with Bernie Sanders almost for the black vote. Wayne, have you noticed that she's Bernie's kind of challenging a little bit?
Yeah, and I tell you, I mean, I'm with Glenda. I'm a little biased when it comes to Sanders. There's something about Sanders, and I'm not saying that his heart may not be in the right direction, but I think a lot of what he's trying to push forward is just unrealistic. It will not be done. You know, that's what bothers me about him. And there's an old Brooklyn phenomenon about his personality, and I'm not going to go into, you know, the what would be considered highly sensational on my part to even comment about that, but I know what I speak of, and anyone who grew up in Brooklyn at that particular time would know what I speak of. I think this is more of an agenda. Well, you know, a black man got in the last time and had a second turn. You know, well, it's time for us to move forward. But, you know, I'm against Bernie when it comes to the right to bear arms, that issue. I think there are too many guns on the street. I think as much as I get aggravated when I have to fork over tons of money for my health care, I do know that universal health care, as long as they have insurance companies in this country like Travelers and all the others that look like kingdoms, you know, it's unrealistic to think that we're going to have that kind of program going on here, you know. And again, if Hillary Clinton were given an opportunity to debate any one of those Republicans,
that's right,
you know, oh, it's all over. And I've seen what abuse that woman, a white woman, in degradation those Republicans mm-hmm. put her through. If she does, if she looks twice her age now, it's because of all the crap that she had to suffer through when her husband was president.
That's right. Well, I agree. And that, and Bernie Sanders, you know, I respect some of the things he's saying, but we have to remember one thing about him. He's been an independent all of his career, and all of a sudden now he's a Democrat. He switched parties.
Exactly.
And he could very easily decide if he loses, okay, to go independent. And he will take half of the Democratic vote and put Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or one of those other crazy men in the White House, okay? And he can easily do that because I'm sorry. Some of the things he's saying, if you just watch what they did to President Obama over the last 8 years, you know that it takes the Congress, it takes the Senate, it takes the president, and it has to be a team. And some of those things he knows now, if he got him in now and it was still a Republican stronghold like they have now, it's no way he could not even – he could tease the people, and young people could supposedly vote for him and believe that stuff that he's talking, but he would not get any of that stuff moving forward. They don't even want President Obama to do what he's supposed to do as the president, to put in a justice in the Supreme Court.
Thank you.
Come on. President Obama said yesterday when he spoke that there were 14 judges that were approved by a judiciary committee with Republicans and Democrats on it. 14 federal judges that they need, and Justice Roberts is begging to get it approved because the courts are overburdened and the judges' caseloads are overburdened, and they refuse to take it up for a vote in the Senate. And these are people who are approved by Republicans and Democrats, and the only reason why they won't do it is because President Obama is the one who put them forward. And how could you say that you're not going to vote for somebody like Marco Rubio said just because he might the person he puts up, if it's a conservative, you wouldn't vote for him just because President Obama nominated him? And that's what he said. He said he doesn't care who it is, he's not voting.
Well, yeah, of
and
course.
This is
that's
a man who wants
that's
to be president.
Hold on. That's the other big story that you kind of moved into that, but I wanted to highlight. Yeah, the Supreme Court Justice Anton Scalia just passed away over the weekend. And, I guess it's a little bit of the Republicans are catching a little bit of blowback because Mitch McConnell couldn't even wait 24 hours before he commented on his replacement. You know, was really even. Could barely wait for the body to be cold before he wanted to hurry up and say, we don't want Obama to appoint anybody. And, you know, he's got almost a whole year, and they showed some other numbers on some of the networks saying that, you know, on average his appointees, of course, take a longer period of time. But, of course, it's within this about 300 days left, 320 days left or something like that. So it's within his presidential responsibility to suggest and to put somebody forth, and it's the Senate's responsibility to deny the person. But certainly, you know, they've been preemptive about President Obama's presidency all along, trying to pull the rug out from underneath him even before he got started. So it's really not surprising that they really want to do all they can to eliminate whatever he's trying to do. You know, it's not surprising at all about what they're trying to do, and more importantly, Eric. I mean, the one thing that just to piggyback on what you're saying, it is written in the Constitution. It is written. Mm-hmm. This is law. You know, you could have Pope Francis as president, and something like that were to happen, he had to follow instructions. The same way, if suddenly the president and were to suddenly lose his life, the vice president would be next, and the head of Congress would be next after that. I mean, there's a blueprint that everyone follows. You know.
Let me interrupt you because we have another guest calling up. Perhaps he'd like to get in on this semi-political conversation. I don't know if he does. Let me introduce everybody to Mr. Richard Wesley. I want to say thank you for calling in to us tonight, famed playwright and screenwriter. extraordinaire of some of the my most favorite works, movies and plays and stuff like that. Hello, Richard Wesley. Are you with us? I see our computer is trying to upload your call, and it is working real hard. The little thing is spinning around. So until we get Richard Wesley clear through the line, we're going to keep talking about a little bit of the politics. Rich, you might want to, let me see if we can take this here and call back. My mom is writing me all kind of notes all of a sudden here, folks. But anyway, Richard, if you can call right back, try to call right back and we'll get you through that time. Maybe you have a couple few people on the line, so we're going to say goodbye to Glenda, our guest, Glenda Taylor, tonight, author of Jalamusa's Drum, one of many books that she's written. Glenda, thanks for calling in, and thanks for your input and your insight, also the politics.
Glenda,
yeah, don't talk. I don't want to talk about politics. I don't want to talk about politics.
I know. You said that.
That's for you and Eric and Wayne.
Yeah. Thanks, Glenda.
Thank you, Glenda. Have a good night.
Good night.
We see that we had Richard Wesley, you know, on the line, and we're telling Richard, please call back. You know, we got very carried away with the political conversation. But Richard is on the air right now. Hello, Richard
yes,
Wesley.
I am.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm
doing Richard.
Fine.
How you doing?
Hey, amen.
How are
everybody?
You, sir? Author Uptown Saturday Night. Let's do it again. Mighty Jets.
All right.
I know I'm leaving a bunch of stuff out, and I know you have a new book out, from what I understand. So,
yeah. I've been fine. Okay. I trying to stay creative, trying to stay active, trying to keep up with everything that's going on out here, you know, especially with this election and, you know, how it, you know, affects us, all of us, you know, going forward. In these years after Obama, you know, that's going to be an interesting thing, as Al Sharpton was pointing that out on a TV show the other day. This will be the first time in history that a black person, a black man, will have been succeeded in the White House by a white man. And like, okay, that's going to be an interesting dynamic for a lot of reasons. And so, you know, looking at the way the election is shaping up and everything, you know, I think a lot of, you know, for a lot of people, especially for African Americans, this is going to be a very portentous time, perhaps the most portentous since Reconstruction.
Right. That's very interesting to say that. We also have Wayne Gilman on the line. I want to tell you that. I know he wants to get in on this discussion too. But also too, I think that I think. Let me just get that. I think that you're very. I agree with you. I was thinking about that as well. What's going to be the issue? Whoever comes in next. I mean, if we get the Republican, will they dial everything back for black people? You know, because I just saw one of the shows was talking about, you know, the Democrats are at least talking about issues of concern to black people, and you don't hear any of the Republicans mention Flint, Michigan, or police violence. You know, it's almost like something they don't care about. So it began me to got me to thinking along those lines. What's going to be, you know, if a Trump or somebody gets in that succeeds, or a crew that succeeds Obama, are they just going to? That's just terrible. I mean, they're already trying to turn the dial back even before he leaves, but it's really interesting to see the effect on African Americans. I mean, especially with the legal process and the criminal justice system, how Obama tried to loosen or correct some things that were systematically sending black and brown young men to jail. And it really is interesting to see what's and kind of you know, a little bit scary, a little bit, to see what's going to happen after he's gone. Wayne.
No, I happen to agree. I mean, I'm more concerned about that because there's a lot of inside talk going on in the media. You know, some of the people I've talked to are still doing, political talk around the country. And the perception is that one of the Republican candidates will wind up. I hope it's not Donald Trump. I mean, I know the president has even gone as far as saying that publicly. The next president will not be Trump. But I don't know. I mean, I'm concerned because, as I voiced a moment ago with our previous guest, I support Hillary. You know, I think the Democrats cannot afford no more political infighting and airing each other's dirty laundry. We know politics is a very dirty game, and that's just how it is. But I would shudder to think what the Republicans will do. We went through 8 years ago a colossal, what I think was a modern-day depression. You're out of work. Anything that of any value, whether you invested on the stock market or tangible investments in real estate, the economy just fell apart, and a Bush was at the switch. And there's a likelihood another Bush may get there again. I don't know. His poll numbers aren't resonating that, but, you know, I just think these are very, very troubling times, and I don't want to sound pessimistic, but I'm equally as concerned what happens next.
Well, yeah, you know, I think everybody should be, somewhat apprehensive about it and also extremely cognizant of everything that's happening in this election, everything that's election season, rather, and everything that's being said, and all of the various issues and everything that are being debated. Though on the Democratic side, at least Clinton and Sanders are debating issues and not getting lost in all of this, personal attack and everything. But to your larger point, I think, we have to, we being, African Americans and other people of color, really have to pay very close attention to what those tensions are that are roiling this current election season. And, I keep going back to Reconstruction. My wife, Valerie, has gotten me interested in reading Du Bois's book, Black Reconstruction, which he actually wrote, right there at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. And so a lot of the memories of what happened in the post-Reconstruction period were still fresh. And Du Bois, of course, had lived through them. He had personal memories as well as the historical record as it existed at that time. And, just remembering that, Rutherford P. Hayes made that deal with, Southern politicians in order for him to get the presidency. And in making that deal, Jim Crow, as a legal system of government, was instated in the South. And we wound up paying a price. It's for nearly 100 years after that, and it came at a point where we were expanding into areas of business and political power. We had elected officials in Congress. We had governors of states, and in a very short period of time, all of that just literally disappeared. So much so that by the time I was a small boy in the 1950s, the only reason I even knew that there was a man named Hiram Bevel and that he had once been, I think, governor of South Carolina,
was mm-hmm. because there was an article about him in Ebony magazine that Lerone Bennett had written.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it existed nowhere in history books. There was no mention of it, and most people would not even have been aware that there were black elected officials in the U.S. Congress and sitting in office, you know, as governors of states in the South during the 1870s. And all of that was just wiped out. And now mm-hmm. here we are with, you know, standing at a precipice in which we can legally lose our voting rights.
Yeah.
Simply,
exactly.
With at the stroke of a pen.
Yeah.
That we can, the police, there are rogue police on police forces all across the country who can now function like the Ku Klux Klan did during the 1880s and 90s, killing us at will, and are not even required to face any kind of sanction for it. And we see it every day. You know, I think it was Michelle Wallace pointed out that that there are rogue cops who are killing our young people at a rate that exceeds the rate of lynchings that occurred in this country during the 1880s and 90s. Mm. You know, so it's like, wow, we have got to be vigilant about what's going on and where we need to stand and who we need to be standing with and who's going to stand with us. Because we really are at a point now where, you know, post-Obama, we could be pulled all the way back to where we were in 1905.
Wow.
That's how I feel, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, someone like, oh, that's too much worry. That's too much, that's hyperbole.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. If you look at a situation like Michigan, right? And this is what I've been talking about, you know, ever since they first initially started talking about this governor's attempts, and really not attempts, is taking over certain municipalities in the state of Michigan and appointing a city manager and just totally wiping out the city government, the duly elected government, mayor and city council of those communities, which happen to be majority black in each one of those circumstances. Because of finances, he blamed it because on the town's going bankrupt as his decision to do this. And Flint was one of them, I believe. And that's how the decision
Flint
was made.
To
save the money to have them drink out of the Flint River, which everybody knows nobody's been drinking out of there for a good 80 years. Everybody was drinking out of, you know, the other river. So to me, it seems intentional that he's trying to murder off a population of people. When the mayor came with a plan that the mayor of Lansing told her about to replace their pipes, and they presented a budget of $55 million, and his office and his administration projected $700 and some odd million, and they were only presenting $55 million, he was still hemming and hawing about the plan. Then when he finally came around, he gave half the money. So is it not clear to everybody that this is intentionally trying to kill off the population? And I think you're very right, Richard, that some of these people, you know, how rabid they are, and just how at the surface, they just at the surface their emotions really are, once they're not getting their way anymore. And the whole notion, the possibility of a truly diverse and equal society has got some people's heads exploding, you know. And it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But we wanted to talk about your book, you know, I mean,
the title of the book is the Richard Wesley Play Anthology. It's it features five plays that I've written, five full-length plays that I've written over the years since 1971.
they are listed in or arrayed in chronological order. With the first play, a political drama I wrote back in 1971 at the Public Theater called Black Terror. And it was a play about young revolutionaries. And it posited what would be taking place if black people actually were engaged in active combat against the government of the United States. So I basically took the revolution, which everyone was always talking about, and I put it on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, you know, then, let's see.
You were a bad man.
I was trying. I remember I won a Drama Desk Award for it, and got a lot of notoriety. In fact, because of that play, I got two or three offers to write movies. Yeah, I remember the first movie offer I ever got was from Anthony Quinn. He came to see the play and wanted me to rewrite some scenes in a movie that he was doing at the time called Across 110th Street.
Wow.
And,
I remember that. Yeah,
but I didn't write those scenes. I was too political at that time to work for Hollywood.
You didn't have no time to be working for the man.
Yeah,
Mr. Honky Man, I got time for you.
I had my dashiki and afro and my combat boots then. I was like, what I look like writing a movie for Hollywood, you know, so. And then the second play was written a couple years later, a full-length play was called The Sirens. And that was really an attempt on my part to really talk about how black women were feeling in terms of self-image in a kind of post-industrial Western society, and how so many different forces in their lives had affected the ways in which they felt. It's set in Newark, and it was kind of loosely based on some things that I had seen with women who were working at the old Mattel factory that used to be in Harrison, and mattress factory that used to be down on Raymond Boulevard in Newark, and everything, and how women were coping, and some of the sisters had even drifted into part-time hustling and prostitution and everything. And but at the same time, they were desperately fighting to hold families together and hold their psyches together. I think I won my first Adelco Award for that play. I think the third play is The Mighty Gents, which ultimately went to Broadway. That was the one that starred Howard Rollins and Morgan Freeman and Dorian Harewood.
Right.
The next one was a play called The Talented Tenth, premiered at the Manhattan Theater Club in New York, but it also played at the Crossroads Theater down in New Brunswick back in the early 90s. And that was about the struggle for control of a black-owned radio station.
Yeah.
And some of the issues that surrounded that the founder of the station, old school brother from the World War II era, was being offered a lot of money to sell it, and he was getting ready to make the sale, but there was his younger executive assistant was saying, we got to hold on to the station. And so he's scrambling, trying to acquire the funds to make a counter offer. And at the same time, he's caught up in a whole midlife crisis himself, and that's interfering with his ability to get things done. And I was really kind of talking about some of the crises of conscience and performance that a lot of, you know, young black people in the early 90s were having, especially people entering, you know, their 40s, their early 40s and everything. And here they were, the talented 10th. They were expected to do, you know, to do big things and getting in the way. And the other piece of the latest play is called Autumn, and it premiered down at the Crossroads Theater back in June. And there are going to be a couple of more performances of it later on, one later on this year at the Billie Holiday Theater in New York, and then another theater in New York right after that. And that play, Autumn, is a play around two generations of black political figures in an unnamed northeastern American city. That one's, I just sort of like pulled together a whole lot of histories of black mayors from different parts of the country and everything, and brought different aspects of them into one character.
Yeah.
So it's an older man. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say we're running out of time. And
okay.
You know, I want to hear more about this, though. Can you come on again next week and continue with this? What's the name of the book that you are?
The book is called the Richard Wesley Play Anthology. I'll be signing copies of it tomorrow evening from 6 p.m. at the Drama Bookshop, 250 West 40th Street in New York City.
Drama
and,
Workshop.
The Drama Bookshop.
Bookshop.
Yeah. It's it's a bookstore that specializes in selling scripts and things of, you know, major plays and stuff like that. It's right on 40th Street, just east of 8th Avenue, almost across the street from the New York Times building. And I'll be there from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. tomorrow night, 250 West 40th Street in New York City.
And that's at the Drama Bookshop.
The Drama Bookshop.
Legendary. You got to come back on so we can talk politics and all the rest, and also those legendary movies that you did.
I'd love to talk about all of that, definitely.
We're happy to finally have you on, and we're going to be having you on again real soon. Mr. Richard Wesley, thanks for calling in, Richard.
And thank you, Wayne Gilman.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening.
Take good care, Wayne. Peace and,
okay,
peace and blessings to you.
Same to you, sir. All
right.
Thank you. Everyone, stay tuned for K Council Live every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. And, Eric?
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Listen to the K Thompson Live show. Once again, thanks to Mr. Richard Wesley, Mr. Wayne Gilman, our other co-host, as always. Thanks, Mom. My name is Eric Payne. I am the son. K Thompson Live every week, every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. on the blogtalkradio.com / Want to say something, Mom? She's leaning over, everybody.
Yeah.
Only when I start saying stuff.
Good program.
Blogtalkradio.com / K Thompson Live. And the shows are archived, so you can listen to them at any time. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Thank you.